Honorable members, members of the media, officials from the department, you are all welcome. We have Mr. Mayor and Mr. Karenda Ross here from the Ministry of Commission to do a briefing. So I want to welcome them and thank them for having a short notice and offer them the platform to do the briefing.
Thank you, Chairperson. I believe the original reports I have not been received yet. Just waiting for that. Maybe in the meantime, I can just introduce my colleague, Ms. Rebecca Makulumaku. She's been appointed, or rather seconded to the Commission for a period of 3 years to assist us with misconduct hearings and all the complaints against members. Maybe she can just introduce herself.
You are welcome. You will be very well to meet this committee. And we hope we have time to listen to you as well. But this is a family. We welcome you. Yeah. So, in view that you don't have the report yet, I'll ask Ms. Ross from the Department of Justice to do that.
Of the submissions on the National Amendment Bill, as well as the responses of the department that have been circulated to the committee. Now going through the submissions made by various interested parties on the bill, we have on the first page under general comments where commentators indicate their support for the principle of the bill. And those would include Competent Justice, Western Cape Ministry of Social Development, Commission for Gender Equality. What I mean there is that they support, although they may have concerns here and there on the bill, they support the objective, the broad objective of the bill, what the bill aims to do. The principle of the bill is to amend the Maintenance Amendment Bill and in the Maintenance Act as an interim measure pending an investigation by the South African Law Reform Commission. This is because over the years, since the Maintenance Act was implemented, various users of the Act have identified areas of the Act that need improvements, because these improvements are necessary to address practical and technical problems experienced with the application of the Maintenance Act. Among others, the bill aims to amend the Act in order to introduce in the bill provisions dealing with the granting of interim orders where there is no maintenance order in place. so that the beneficiary of maintenance do not suffer while the case on or an inquiry is being postponed for whatever reason. The other area of importance in the bill is the provisions that deal with the that grant the court the power to direct electronic service providers to furnish the court with the contact particulars of a maintenance defaulter or a would-be respondent of a maintenance claim. That is specifically meant to assist beneficiaries of maintenance where maintenance inquiries have to be postponed for lengthy periods because for whatever reason, among others, that the defaulter or a would-be respondent of a maintenance claim cannot be traced. There are also in general terms, okay, the bill also seeks to extend the jurisdiction of the National Court in order to enable a claimant of maintenance or beneficiaries to also be able to institute claims of maintenance in areas where they affect and not necessarily where they reside, because that is said to inconvenience the claimant of maintenance. There are also provisions or proposed provisions to have the contact, to have the information, the details of a person owing on maintenance to be submitted to credit providers or to institutions that deal with credit rating. That is in order to prevent persons owing on maintenance to continue receiving credit while they are owing on maintenance and those who they are who have a right of maintenance from them continue to suffer. The bill also aims to give effect to various judgments of the court on issues relating to maintenance that have been before court, and one in particular is that the court contemplating a maintenance order against a person must give a person or the employer of a person who against whom a maintenance order is contemplated an opportunity to be heard, and amongst other that is to give evidence to the court on the feasibility of the maintenance order. Now coming to the summary of the submissions that were made by the interested parties after the bill was published for comment. All in all, 15 submissions were received on the bill. And the summary that the members have contained a summary of all those 15 submissions that were made. And on page 1 of the summary, like I've already indicated, Solidarity and Justice, Western Cape Minister of Social Development, Commission for Gender Equality, the Upper Bank, and society indicate their general support for the bill. And now coming to submissions on the specific topic. In respect of clause 1, the Commission for Gender Equality indicates support for the bill, for the clause, for that is clause 1, and the department needs that. Also, on clause 1, the GCG would be the chief bar parliamentary committee of the General Council of the Bar, indicates that the new category in clause 1, which places an obligation on a maintenance officer to institute an inquiry where would call again for the substitution or decide of a verbal or written agreement, will ensure that a de novo inquiry is not held. And this indicates support, and the department knows that. Mr. Murana submits that the discharge of or substitution of a maintenance order for a person being liable to maintain any other person is provided for in section 6, subsection 1, paragraph 8 of the Act. That is just restating what is provided in the Act, and we know that. Still on clause 5, Ms. Fanita, who is a magistrate and who deals with maintenance inquiry, submits that a simplified procedure should be created to enable verbal and written maintenance agreements to be made and what of court. He said I was going to say, while a remedy should be created for those persons who have managed to come to some form of agreement to be able to have the certainty of formalizing their agreement by means of a court order, as the bill does, this remedy should not shut the door on those persons who do not want to involve the court in the maintenance of their children. In response, the department submits that a deal is held that where parties can agree on their own maintenance, there is no reason why they should be forced to go to court unless they can no longer agree. The bill does not affect this position. A second submission by Mr. Van Dijk on clause 1 goes as follows. The legislator should provide clarity on the interaction between agreements reached between parties and maintenance orders that have been made. That is what effect that a verbal or written agreement had on an existing maintenance order. Mr. Anita alleged that evidence is frequently tendered during maintenance matters that the parties have reached an agreement which is in conflict with the existing maintenance order. He contends that the wording of the proposed new section 6, subsection 1, paragraph C, would allow maintenance defaulters to raise the excuse of alleged verbal agreement which departs from an existing maintenance order. He goes on further to say that if the provision is enacted as it is, it results in complaints being turned down on technical grounds because section C, subsection 1, paragraph 2 and C are listed in the alternative. From the department side, we do not agree with this contention. The proposed new section 6, subsection 1, paragraph B, envisages a situation where maintenance order exists at all. The scenario cast by the financial cannot happen. If there is an existing maintenance order in place, there is no room for verbal or written agreement between the parties, which will be in conflict with the order. In a case such as this, the parties must approach court for an order to be substituted if that is what parties have agreed to themselves. Once a maintenance order is in place, it must be complied with to the letter until it is amended or discharged at the maintenance court. in order to address the concern of this refinery, so that there are no ambiguities in this regard, it must be appropriate to reword the new proposed section 6, subsection 1C as follows. Before I go on to the chair, there is a type of thing where the report where it has listed Pandurian. It's not Pandurian, it's supposed to be Pandurian. And we propose as follows. That in paragraph C, that would cause exists for the substitution of this type of a verbal or written agreement in respect of maintenance obligations, and for the words in bold and in square brackets to be deleted and then be substituted by in respect of which there is no existing maintenance order. This would be to make it clear that a maintenance, there cannot be a verbal or written agreement between the parties when there is an existing maintenance order in place. Going on further with regard to Mr. Vanika's submission, point 3 in respect of clause 1. It says there is presently no measure or system in place whereby children placed in foster care can be cross-referenced to maintenance payments being made for the same children where they are where the foster care order and the maintenance order are laid in different areas or provinces. As is the case with the Children's Act, the area of jurisdiction for maintenance claims should be limited to the area where the person to be maintained is ordinarily resident. This alignment will ensure the verification of information and prevent any unlawful duplication of payments for children. In our response, we say the following. The current provision in terms of which a maintenance beneficiary can only institute a claim for maintenance in the ministerial district of one's place of residence inconveniences beneficiaries who may be working and residing in different ministerial districts. They may be forced to take time away from work, which could have negative impact for them. Usually, such workers will be involved in foster care arrangements and any duplication should be picked up by them. Administrative help of the nature as outlined in the financial should not frustrate the object of this law. Administrative hurdles of this nature must be dealt with in terms of law. As suggested by Mr. Fanega in his submission, these observations of this fall outside the scope of the amendment in question. This chair is because Mr. Fanega indicated that he is aware that this specific submission falls outside the ambit of the bill and he nevertheless proceeded to make it. Now, coming to submissions in respect of clause 2, the Case General Counsel of the Bar submitted the mechanism created for the payment of the cost for providing the contact information of the defaulter to the court and the possible recovery thereof by way of proposed amendments to Section 20 of the Act seems to me to be the most feasible, and we look there. Kotaku also made a submission in respect of clause 2, where they indicate that the requirement that complainants pay for the cost of providing contact information of defaulters to the court will have hardship to women as they constitute the majority of maintenance complainants. The commentator proposes that the Department of Justice establishes a fund from which such costs can be paid. In response to that, the department submits that state funds are limited. The question will inevitably arise why harassment complainants who are also often women and children do not enjoy the same benefits in terms of the Protection from Harassment Act, which requires the victim to pay for this court. The maintenance court can, in terms of clause 8 of the bill, make an order for the cost to be borne by the maintenance defaulter. The amount payable. Ken, our response to that is that we cannot run away from the fact that state funds are limited, and like this provision in the bill is similar to that provision in the Protection from Harassment Act, and in mostly the complainants in harassment cases are women and children, and today the question could be raised that as to why the victims of harassment are not afforded the same benefit or the cost of obtaining the contact information of the stalker to be paid by on their behalf by the state. We not say that the bill makes also aims to amend section 20, which provides for court to say the court bearing into taking into account the conduct of the party may make an order for the cost, the paid cost to be recovered from the defaulter if the defaulter is ultimately paid.
We'll debate later, but you see, if anything is dependent on safety, the defaults, it means that in the meantime, we keep it with the child. And that cannot be the best interest of the child. Anyway, proceed.
Coming to the comment of the Commission for Gender Equality on Clause 2, Point one is familiar that the complainant should not have to bear the cost for the provision of information by the service provider. This should be borne by the service provider, who could possibly be allowed to levy a charge against the relevant customer. The response that I've given in respect of point in item 7 is also relevant, because this comment of the CBT relates to the same issue. The CBT continues to say or to propose that the clause should be revised by inserting the wish as well as any family member after provider on page 3 in line 3. This comment relates to the part of clause 2 that requires electronic service providers to provide information to the court. And in responding thereto, we say in terms of section 8 of the Act, a legislative name, either before or during a maintenance inquiry and at the request of a maintenance officer, request the appearance of any person before a magistrate for examination on information regarding the identification or place of residence or employment of any person who is allowed to maintain any other person or the financial position of any person affected by such lodging. This provision covers any natural person, including a family member of a person allowed to maintain another. So the Act already covers this submission. In item 9, still on clause 2, the Ministry of Social Development of the Western Cape proposes that the WES have not gone through on page 3 in 2016, be substituted for have failed to locate the whereabouts of the person. The WES used in the bill and those suggested by the commentator mean the same thing, namely that the efforts to trace the person have not produced any successful result.
Why is it not important to call a spade a spade? Why have not gone to this one? They have failed to locate the whereabouts of the person. It's not just about locating whereabouts, but bearing fruit. It's not too general. So once you have gone to the amended.
Sir, if you go down on the response of the department on the question, it answers the very question that you're raising, and to saying that that consideration could be given to substituting the web as a submission, and the department does not have any objection there. In item 10, dealing with the submission by Vodacom, still on clause 2, Vodacom proposes that the web prescribed information must be defined. In our response, we say the Act already defined the word prescribed to mean prescribed by regulation. It is not advisable to also define prescribed information as the bill and the Act contain words such as prescribed form and prescribed manner. Clause 2 requires regulation, and prescribed information means that the information will be prescribed in the information, giving the regulation rather. Role players will be given an opportunity to comment on the regulations to be made, where they can give input on the information that will need to be prescribed, and that will assist them in providing the information that may be requested by the court. Vodacom goes on to propose that the revised proposed new section 7 subsection 3 paragraph D on page 3 in line 31 should be substituted as follows, or that the following paragraph should be added there too. That the information referred to in paragraph D shall be provided to the maintenance court within 30 days of receiving the notice when the information is available. And to that, we say determining the days within which to provide the information to the court in legislation may be restricted and may not work for all electronic service providers, since not all of them have commented on the 30-day limitation proposed by Vodacom. Prescribing the DS in legislation will also take away the discretion of the court. And experience has often shown that provision of an inflexible data as proposed gives rise to problems. Point 3 of Vodacom still under clause 2, he submits that the instances where an employer has taken a post-paid contract on behalf of its employees or the employees, the contact information of the user will be in the possession of the employer and not necessarily the service provider. Therefore, the bill should make provision for the transfer of the request to the employer of the user. There we take it that Vodacom proposes that the service provider should be able to direct or submit the directive of the court to the employer. In response to say allowing the ESP to transfer the direction of the court to provide information the third party may present and present challenges for court. The bill provides for the electronic service provider to apply for cancellation of the direction on the grounds and others that he does not have the information on his record. In this case, the electronic service provider will be in a position to indicate this fact to the court, and the provisions of Section 8 of the Act can then be revoked by the court. Another proposal from Telecom, from Vodacom, is that the bill should make provision that a fee for sending the court with the contact information of the user or defaulter of mention must be paid in full prior to directing the service provider to provide the court with the required information.
The bill provides that the fee for tracing should be paid to the service provider, and we are making better proposals. So the service provider is Vodacom, and then the beneficiary is the one who, for now, in terms of our proposal, will have to get the cost of tracing.
No commission has been received to the extent that the court who needs access to justice will not get it because it's conditional upon payment. So the court also cannot commission unless there's proof of payment.
That is a submission that is made by Vodacom as a service provider today. Attending or commenting further on their submission. In their submission, they say they are struggling to get payment for being prepared to the protection, for tracing, for the purpose of the protection for harassing.
Which means they are making access to justice for children dependent on market forces.
I say it's their permission, and one can only imagine that it's because they are a business and that they are
You are in the Department of Justice. Let's hear from the Department of Justice. What are you doing?
Chair, we've already indicated that due to limitation of the resources, that similarly to a provision in the Protection from Harassment Act that companies pay for the cost of providing the information. But as the bill is now before the committee, I think we will be guided by the committee. As the bill stands, the Department of Justice proposes that the cost be borne by the companions in the information
system. So, are you not suggesting that the cost be initiated and the cost order then be later is recovered from the maintenance payment? That is a provision in the fact that the payable can be recovered in terms of the cost order. Is that not?
What we are saying is that because if it happens that a defaulter or would-be respondent is not traced, and if you want to go further in the submission, in our response to this submission today, we propose that the provision be amended to make clear that the amount payable will be prescribed and are paid by the person lodging the complaint. So there it would make it clear that it should be the complainant who pays the money.
Right.
If the altar is only money, and now you are looking for him so that you can recover the money, so the cost can also be part of the money that can be recovered from him. Because if the complainant has to pay, it means where complainants are not able to pay, children will not access justice. And is that what you want to say?
I just want to point out, Madam, in criminal cases, the service provider is not. I say in criminal cases, the service provider is just entrusted to be invited by the other police to give information related to that. Why can't you make such a provision? He can recover it from his own subscriber. Yes, hey, why can't you make such a break?
So like I've already indicated, there may be cases where the altar is not safe. The service provider does not have the contact details of that person, and hence that person cannot be actioned. And the service provider, during our consultation with them, taking cues from the provision of the Protection from Harassment Act, made it clear to us that they would be prepared to provide the information as directed by the court for a fee. But it should be borne in mind that the information, the contact details, contact information of the respondent or service provider may be required even before the maintenance proceeds into an inquiry before it goes to court, where the maintenance investigator is involved, and that this provision is meant to or taken by electronic service provider is meant to be a matter of last resort.
I want you to proceed, but just to say, you are comparing apples and oranges. The victims of harassment, I want to assume, are adults. But when we deal with children, we must be guided by the best interests of the children. Proceed with that.
Because as I indicated, the cost will be, can be recoverable. Are you in agreement with me? Look at your H, look at clause 2H. The tariffs payable to are subject to section 20. Now section 20, if you read it, is ordered as the cost for service. The court can make an order as the cost. So the court can order that the defaulter pays those costs. So there are two separate issues that we need to look at, Chair. But there is a provision here, subject to 20, that the maintenance order, once the person has been found, they then can, and maybe we need to button that up, they can require that the defaulter pay that amount as well as what's your position. But I've also got a note that during our, when we were briefed on it, it said the cost is 80 rand, and the cellular providers don't charge those. That the main use of it is a flat of issue. Is that, that's a note of course that we received during our briefing. Is that correct or not?
That's correct. The thing is, we took it from the position that facing in harassment cases, which is in respect of which the act is already in place, might be very minimal compared to cases where tracing has to be done in respect of maintenance defaulters. And there, our view was that the service providers may change a different view because then there will be many a case of tracing to be
involved. I think we must just follow what Honorable Sarki said. For me, it would make sense. But what the explanation shows that we want to really look after the interests of the market forces at the expense of children. We can't go along with that. I think look at what Honorable Sarki said and then rethink the matter. But proceed with the rest.
Okay. On to. Point 5 of still on Vodacom submission, and that is on page 7. They submit that the direction issued by the court should relate to identifiable data records and a specific time period to allow the service provider to ascertain with certainty when last the number was used. We note this. And further submit that the information that will assist the service provider in identifying the person whose issues are required will be prescribed through regulation. Still on clause 2, dealing with the submission of Mrs. Vanida, he submits that similar provisions in the Protection from Harassment Act were introduced to deal with the situation where the person or source of the harassment is not known, and these powers are utilized to change the source. Section 8 of the Act grants the maintenance cost powers that are wide enough to obtain information even from electronic service providers. We respond that this clause will be beneficial to maintenance beneficiaries since it will provide the court with contact information of would-be respondents and defaulters. This will contribute to the finalization of maintenance inquiries and provisions pending against the defaulters. It is the same method that is used to trace the stalker. But an end of the Act does not have the details process provided for in clause 2. And it is therefore inadequate for purposes of setting the process. The mechanism proposed in clause 2 is also used as a measure of last resort, and any directive must be authorized by a court. Still on financial submission, it is submitted that if clause 2 is retained, the use of electronic service providers as a last resort will hinder the investigation of maintenance complaints. A maintenance officer should be able to decide which course of action to take in tracing the defaulter. The requirement that the tracing by service provider should be used as a last resort should be deleted from the bill. We respond that it is necessary to have uniformity in tracing the defaulter in the country. The regulation of the use of service providers in obtaining information of defaulters is therefore necessary. Allowing maintenance officers any discretion in the use of service providers may give rise to inconsistencies. The use of service providers as a matter of last resort will save contingent costs to be paid to service providers, and only costs should be able to give this authorization where other attempts have failed. On point 3 of Mr. Fanida's submission, he proposes that the proposed payment of tracing costs should be extended to other institutions that provide information to the court and should not only be applicable to electronic service providers. Alternatively, that the payment of costs should be deleted from the bill. We propose that this possibility be explored by the South African Reform Commission in its investigation into the maintenance system, for instance, where banks could be included as tracers. This will, however, require further research and engagement with the institution in question. The last submission by Mr. Fanitek on clause 2 is that if the payment of costs for providing information is retained in the bill, it should be provided for in section 8 of the Act. We want that it should be noted that section 8 of the Act deals with different types of examination of persons in maintenance by the maintenance officer. Section 20, on the other hand, deals with court order, and therefore of the view that the amendment is appropriately placed in section 20 of the Act.
Passive individual needs to look at the process. I was thinking that one needs to strengthen section 20, because section 20 refers only to service of the service of a female company. Okay. Maybe we need to strengthen section 20 to look at including other costs as well, such as tracing costs, which will include recovery of that tariff as well. So we need to just have a look at that would be the basis later today.
On that token, I just mentioned that there's already an amendment, a proposed amendment in section 20 dealing with that. I'm referring to the proposed amendment that the cost for trading by service provider be paid for by the conveyance. Yes, I'm cognizant of the fact that the committee will still need to look at that as to for the payment of the cost. But that is already covered in that end. Like honorable to affairs that we need strengthening. Now coming to item 12 dealing with clause 3 of the bill, the Commission for the Land Equality submits that a penalty provision is proposed in respect of the conviction of a person who willfully fails to comply with the subpoena or furnishes the court with incorrect information. The CCE proposes a fine or a period of imprisonment not exceeding 1 year. So that's to say, the proposal by the CCE here is already provided for in terms of existing law. For example, in contempt of court or a touch of the city's end of justice and the offense of prison. Sections 33, 34, and 35 of the Act also deals with various offenses relating to maintenance issues. Vodacom makes a further submission on clause 3, and they submit that the word any in clause 3 in line 5 includes a juridic person. To say that therefore electronic service providers should be excluded from the operation of clause 3 if they have complied fully with the directive to furnish the court with contact particulars of the following in terms of clause 2 that are already clause 2. And in response to the clause 2 and 3 of the bill, deal with two different purposes. Clause 2 amends section 7 of the Act and deals with tracing of defaulters, and that is relevant for the investigation of complaints.
Clause 3, on the other hand, relates to the actual area where a person will be subpoenaed to give evidence. Clause 2 does not involve a subpoena. The service provider may even be the employer of a person who has an obligation to maintain another person. Therefore, it is not possible to exempt electronic service providers from the operation of Clause 3. Coming to Clause 4, dealt with from Item 14, Kosatu submits that the introduction of interim orders in the maintenance regime is welcome, and the department looks at. The Chief General Counsel of the Bar may also make a submission in respect of Clause 4, and the implemented orders will go a long way in ameliorating the effect of a long drawn out maintenance requirement. The effect of this amendment is that a maintenance court cannot make orders with retrospective effect evidence. An interim order can be substituted with a different order at a later stage. And we know that. The CCB continues to say the bill should set limits for the conclusion of maintenance inquiries. The department responds that setting limits for the conclusion of maintenance inquiry is undesirable, as it will take away the discretion of the court. Experience has shown that provisions of an inflexible nature as proposed give rise to problems of their own. The bill enjoins the court to conclude maintenance inquiries as easily as possible and to limit postponement. An interim order will compensate for postponement if there is a need for that. That is, if there is a need for a postponement. An interim order will ensure that the beneficiary receives maintenance and the person obliged to pay maintenance will also not delay the matter unnecessarily, as an interim order may not be in one's favor. Coming to still on to form, dealing with the comments of Ms. Fanica, is that the requirement that prima facie evidence must exist before an interim order can be made set the bar too high. We respond that the order of this nature cannot be made in the air. It must be based on some evidence registering prima facie evidence. The need for prima facie evidence also takes up for cases where there may be an issue of where paternity of a child has been in dispute. Further on Mr. Van Niga's proposal, he submits that the proposed amendment does not go far enough and does not cater, for instance, where a respondent made an offer for an increased maintenance payment, which is unacceptable to the applicant. Mr. Vanita is of the view that the court should be able to make an order on the basis of the amount offered by the respondent, although that will be on an interim basis, which he argues will go a long way in addressing the needs of the applicant as opposed to no relief at all. In this regard, Mr. Vanita refers to instances where the applicant is not necessarily applying for a maintenance order, where there is none issued. But it is rather referring to instances where the applicant is applying for an increase in maintenance where there is already a maintenance order in place. The aim of the clause is, however, to put in place a mechanism for making an interim maintenance order where there is none in place. The plain meaning of the word used in the clause, namely interim maintenance order, in place just says that it is an interim order, as does the wording of the provisions of the proposed new section 10 subsection 6, paragraph B, item 1 and 2. This is confirmed by the fact that the amendments in the bill are contained in section 10 of the Act, which deals with entire financial costs. If interim orders are to be made in the case of existing maintenance orders, it is suggested that they be included in section 16 of the Act. They should, however, specifically from a language point of view, not be referred to as interim orders, but should rather be referred to as interim orders substituting existing maintenance orders. In order to achieve the primary objective of clause 4 of the bill, it is proposed that reference to section 16, subsection 1E of the Act in line 31 of the bill on page 4 be deleted. There is, however, a substance in the comments of Mr. Van Nicken, which the committee might wish to consider, namely for maintenance costs to be able to make interim maintenance order in the case of existing maintenance order relating to any application for the increase, reduction, or discharge of the maintenance of maintenance obligation. The committee will, however, need to consider this proposal. Any amendment for such purpose is suggested to require further research and possible consequential amendments.
If people are applying for an interim order where none exists, shouldn't that be catered for? Why should you, this interim order only relate to cases where order for relief?
In respect of this interim order, not properly following what will be the case where there is that the dispute on issues of patentage. The extent which you comply with the principle of one of other families in terms of this interim order. I'm not getting settled in terms of that.
Also, Advocate Ross and Honorable Bonga, let's limit this use of flexing weight. Don't go on a party because we want the public to understand what we're saying. They're going to let the other thing be
Thank you, sir.
Yes, Honorable
Chair, what this means is that the bill currently or the aim thereof is to make an interim order for maintenance where there is no maintenance order in place. Now, in the submission of Mr. Van Nicken, he said there may be an interim order, there may be a need for an interim order where there is an order in place, but the interim order will be related to either reduction, substitution of some sort. And hence, we are proposing again, after visiting the provision and in line with this comment, that perhaps a thinking could be made for a position where there is an interim order in place, because the bill covers a position where there is not interim order.
Right. Yeah, but
I'm coming to that. On the issue of paternity, the bill proposes that there be prima facie evidence or lack of and that would mean the court will need to consider several factors, including whether the paternity is an issue, dispute of opportunity of the time. Because if that is in issue, then the court will not proceed to make an interim order when the person who is alleged that is the father of the child and therefore obliged to maintain the child alleged that he is not the father of the child. So in that case, a maintenance order would not be, an interim order would not be made. It will only be made if there is a prima facie case.
In main thing was, that is why I had to repeat that it's the principle of law, Chair, I'm sorry. But that principle says, they call it the bond of other families. It simply says, whoever has been appointed by the mother to be the father, he is taken to be the father until proven otherwise. That is the principle of law. Now, I was just asking, how do we consider that this is a prima facie? Prima facie and so on, because we have an already existing principle of law. And how do we cater for that in the bill?
But you see also where Mr. Panika has the right to make his submission, but you have a duty to ensure that those submissions, if they are contrary to principles of law, you put them aside.
I think consideration of prima facie case would actually fit in the purpose of the bill in terms of the provision that requires the interim order. That's something to really avoid undue hardship. Because in the context of you trying to actually change that thing, it could then happen to the children.
Thank you, Jen. The issue of paternity or disputes of paternity is a matter of evidence. It will require to be treated as such, meaning that it will have to be proven in court. If the quiet father disputes the fact that he is the father, then he must provide the court.
I think you were dealing with something like a presumption that it is presumed that the person pointed at is the father. And then we grant an interim order or just on that presumption. And then later the court went meaning that that's where the court comes. Evidence comes in. But now we're dealing with an interim situation. We have been pointed at, and then we assume that we have been correctly pointed at, and an interim order will be granted at this.
Chair, even that, on that presumption, is still a matter of evidence. It is a presumption that is made because one also needs to guard against a situation where a person is pointed as a father and the person disputes that he's not a father and the court nevertheless proceeds to make an order for the complainant to be faced with a shame for damaging the interstate. So, to require that there should be prima facie evidence because the provision also goes on to say that the court will need to consider whether the person entitled to be maintained will not suffer undue hardship. So it's both sides, it will protect both the complainant and the person who may be pointed out as the father. Because if the court nevertheless proceeds and makes.
I think we're missing the point, Chief. The main issue that we're dealing with. We have a principle of law on the other side, and on the other side, want to legislate about interim court orders. If there's no one who can just come here from the Western Teaching and just find it me, and say, I'm a father, for instance, it can't be a point. But once a person says, were saying that in the interim,
yes.
In the interim, because the paper of law says the one pointed by the mother is presumed until you prove. And once you dispute, obviously the process of going to the to the hospital starts. Anyone who disputes the process starts to go to the to do the paternity processes and so on. So I think we need to generally cover that interim, because more often than not, you find that the person, it turns out to, that the person is a father. You just want to delay the process, because that's why in the main one, it is interim measures. They know the paternity will come for 6 months and so on, in 6 months period, what happens? Then the poor children is going to be suffering and may even die in the process. When the paternity comes back, they are also of no use. There's nothing wrong, if you're not the father, you come back and say, I want my man, leave the paternity proof, otherwise you can request your man. Then they go to the next. Yeah. The next one was saying, oh, yes, the next.
Thank you, Chair President. I'm under the impression that there is a clause set up with Chicha for the concerns that I actually expressed by Honorable Bongo. In the event an order is given and it's found out data that is actually based on false information, that if a woman alleges that her husband has got so much money and they claim too much money, and then the husband manages to, along the way, prove that they don't have the type of money or the kind of money that was alleged to be owned, then they can actually manage to get back their money. This is not the same thing.
You see, the other thing is that if Honorable Bongo is wrongly pointed out and he paid, the true father is found, then the money is recovered from the true father before him, and then the best interest of the child would be served. Because you don't have an interim period where the child has to suffer while you are looking for these loans. Honorable Lakuma.
I think this law of law is a framework. You have to presume guilty until you're proven. I'm saying that the principle that Honorable Promise is bringing is a wealthy, a prime sentence of morality, our principle, because it actually assumes that two things. One, the lady is innocent, and all what he's saying is that the man must suffer because he has been poisoned, until it is proved that he is not wrong. Now, I don't think it is fair. I agree with the lady that we need facts to check this proof of what he said.
There must be some information as to say, you remember we are alive, or some kind of information. Not just because that point is that he is wrong, unless there is other evidence that shows that they had some relationship and so on and so on. I think this is what but you can't just say, because I'm pointing at you, you are the one.
Of all the African language that I know, it is said that the only person who knows the father of the child is the mother. And I don't think that there is any woman who can just out of the blue say, you are the father. They must have something that was happening between the two of you, and that should, in the interim, suffice as a basis for this woman to point at you. And I think that men must be protected. But the best interest of the children must come first. So we'll have our battles later on. But the children, in the meantime, must be fed, must be protected, and so on. So, Honorable One, maybe you would want to assist us. Tell us in Africans whether the children the fathers of children are not known, must again.
Amazingly, I'm agreeing with the Honorable Mpulwana. The fact is that I think it can never, the best interest of the child can never override a situation where we can merely act on the pointing of a finger by mother. That cannot be accepted in law. At the risk of giving extreme examples, it may be that the mom I feel that one guy with a bit more money is a father, but many mothers are simultaneously involved with more than one man. I think the department is quite correct in saying that if there is a dispute as to the paternity of the child, it is unacceptable in our law, in terms of our constitutional principles, to merely on say-so of a mother in the interim expect of a man to pay the maintenance. What is in the best interest of the child is to ascertain the fact as quickly as possible and then finalize the maintenance inquiry as soon as possible, but never to expose a possible non-father to payment. Because we must also remember that it's not as simple as saying that, okay, if you pay and you were not the father, you will get the money back from either the mum or the real father. Because the problem from the outset is that the issue is at the maintenance court because of scarcity of money. So we will expose the non-father or the innocent man to financial loss which may be even irrecoverable if he merely acts on the side of our mother.
Can we leave this matter? I think we need to look at the social question. If it's going to take us 2 years to resolve the thing of paternity and all these things, by that time, where will these children? By the time you get money for them, they're dead, they're malnourished, they're mentally tired and so on. I think that the very interest of the child should be what guides them. Not thinking that men will suffer. If men sit around all over, they must then, they are opening themselves to be pointed at, and they must take the consequences of being pointed at.
Can I just mention in respect of that, just to show that paternity does become an issue in this matter. There was a case in the media sometime this week where a soccer star was pointed out by this woman as a father. They ran the test and then the test came out, and this week it was reported that that soccer star is not the father. So
nothing wrong with that. The thing is, in the meantime, I think it should be clear to what is the intention of what we want to do in this case. The main intention is about the interim arrangement. So I think that is the main intention. If it does happen that they point me and I am bold to go to the paternity and it's not me, then at least the truth is in front. But
the risk
will
be on the
charge. But more often than not shared, the mother will not just point a gun. However, will want to involve more than one, but it will be one of those who involved. It will be one of those who are involved. And then that's why they're British. So I think our intention is to cater for the interim measures.
I really sympathize with the chair and the reform. I really sympathize. They really believe that people are innocent. In most cases, a woman can find a truth. We have never met. We don't even know a woman. She said, yes. And then you go and say, and you can even destroy your family sometimes. Somebody just, your wife can say, and you have to be just. Anyway, all I'm saying is that there has at least to be a prima facie evidence that you must have admiration. Mere finding, that's what I'm talking about. If a woman says, that is a man, and then man says, I don't even know you, I've never met you. And there's an interim order, until there is time. All I'm saying is that we believe that the woman is so innocent, really, we go to heaven alone.
looking back a little bit, those who practice law in the criminal court, an argument about whether or not the prima facie case can take a week or 2 weeks. Now we are saying we are dealing with an interim situation. Now if you make prima facie case a condition, it means that both sides must even have lawyers to come and argue and all the things. So all that would be at the expense of the children. Anyway, proceed. Honorable Magali.
I think what is said is that you're actually giving an example of something that actually now moves us away from what the intention of the deed is all about. We all know that, especially in divorce cases, we find that the case will take, and as long as there's no order, half the time children suffer. So this position that we're actually today trying to be working on, to try to help in such cases also. So that while the divorce is going on, the children can be maintained. Because half the time, you find that for the women who can afford, and not saying that it's only women who can pay maintenance, they use Section 43 of the Divorce Act to get the maintenance, but the women who can't afford, we have to wait until the divorce is over, until there's an order of the court that articulates the maintenance, how the maintenance process will be like, and then that the children actually manage to benefit from the maintenance order. So what we are actually looking at is a situation that's going to take care of cases that are delaying, that actually compromise the children and causes undue hardship for children.
Okay,
coming to the submission, still on fraud, the submission of Mr. Fanica, still on fraud 4, in this point 3, he says, and whose hardship is an unnecessary requirement and may nullify the good intentions of the legislature. We found that the court needs to establish whether the complainant will suffer some form of hardship. The bill suggesting undue hardship. And the concept of interim order is something entirely new in our law. And undue hardship has therefore been suggested, meaning that the applicant must make out a case for a proper case for an interim order, which is in itself is quite a drastic measure. The president therefore proposes the intention of undue hardship rather than just hardship. Orders of this nature should not be made lightly. On the last point of Mr. Panita, still on top 4, it says, a person against whom an interim order is named may also suffer undue hardship. For instance, where the respondent cannot afford to continue paying maintenance as a result of having been retrenched. The requirement of the existence of undue hardship operates only in favor of a person to be maintained. This clause should be extended to also cover a person against whom the maintenance order is made. And we declare that these comments are made on the assumption that an interim order can also be made in respect of existing maintenance orders. And that has already been discussed and understood.
We want to skip over this document. You are coming there tomorrow. And we also want to offer you an opportunity to sleep over this document and come back fresh tomorrow so we can give it. We want to release you at this point and deal with the next issue. I like what you said, that interim orders are new in our act, which means we must think out of the box. So tomorrow when you come back, you must be operating outside the box. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think a question on paragraph 2.5. I want to know how would it be privilege? How would this whole thing civilize this big case? Jefferson is representing for state. Do you give evidence in a disciplining way before they testify court? In defense, if they're able to take the witness testimony in the Supreme Inquiry and what has been said in court, what will be said in court, and they will compare then the defense would know exactly what the case would be, even before they thought, with being the evidence of the state. And the owners of truth is different. In the Supreme Inquiry, we only have to prove on the balance of probability. That's what the reason does. So, and we even may need evidence for all witnesses which are not called by the state. It's a different approach. And at this stage, the matter is very, very sensitive. That's why there's a trial within a trial. At this point, the whole system is a fight. It's more as the manner in which the chap was set. The authenticity and the authority, everything was suspected in this case. That's another trial, if you do have dispute, that's in the criminal and in the defending side, Chairperson, then we'll have to meet that evidence as well. I think the committee is quite well aware of the burden of proof on two issues.
You know that in the other one, the proof beyond the doubt. In the other one, the balance of proof is quite. It's like Jefferson, we did take some presentation similar to this one. So I'm just worried about how consistent we are getting to be as a committee, because we did take certain decisions. So if today we have to suspend this one, or when in the past, I know in the past cases, when we had similar cases, you would remember was when we said you must go back and kill that, how do we reconcile the two? At what stage do we just leave the issues to move? At what stage should we just allow the state to tell us, the prosecution to tell us what to do and on? And empowered by which legislation, because who would have to follow the legislation to the latter in defending these issues?
Before you respond, let's say Honorable Stark and Honorable Dillon. I think they also
So it's an issue that we've been grappling with for many, many years, and that is where the disciplinary action but delayed pending the outcome of a criminal action. And I think that is the challenge that continually comes up. Whilst there have been concerns about delays with the finalisation of disciplinary actions, we don't want to prejudice criminal cases. And I think that in this particular case, this is one of the few that I've actually seen the National Prosecuting Authority where they requested the Commission not to commence because of the sensitivity of evidence. So it's an issue of justice at the end of the day. And I agree with my colleague that one needs to have a degree of consistency. And this is an issue in a broader principle that we might want to meet with the Magistrate Commission at some stage. We've got Mr. Horn, we've got other members of Parliament that represent us on the Magistrate Commission as well, but they don't sit in on the disciplinary decisions or the Ethics Committee. So we have in the past, as a committee, gone to meet with, I think you were with us, Jefferson, I'm not sure you were previously, where we went to sit with the Magistrate Commission where they could then assist us in having a better understanding of how to deal with the two issues of disciplinary action. But I fully appreciate the concerns that from the prosecutor side, that if evidence is led, that it strengthens the defense in the criminal case, because they then not only have the statement, but they've also got oral evidence that is led, and it makes it very difficult then from the prosecutor side to get a conviction, because their standard is on a much higher standard, beyond reasonable doubt. So our premise must be for justice and to enable the prosecutors to do their job sufficiently. But there must be, I agree with my colleague, consistency then in how we deal with the issue. Thank you, Chair.
I think the reason, I'm not sure, but I think the reason why the prosecution asked for this case is a seriousness of it. And I think that maybe if it is difficult to prove certain points, it might be important that woman they did or we suspend the disciplinary action. Maybe some information that can produce or can somehow affect the criminal case. It might have its effect that there will be evidence. Because this is a very serious case and a very serious case, a sensitive case. Now, I don't think there is a harm to suspend the disciplinary action. I don't think there is anything that is pushing that there should be a disciplinary action. I think the cases are different. Some others are minor, some others are not so crucial. And I think this case is a very serious case.
But you see, all of the Bonga not only says we have to be consistent, he says by what legal authority are we taking this?
Let me say, the law is made for the people, not people for the law. The cases are completely different from everything. They are very different. And I think if I was a prosecutor, I would protest in this case. That because of the seriousness of the case, I think, I don't know. But I think that we should not deny them that request. They know what.
Exercising our duty or discharging our duty if the report today says that there was no intention really to go on with the disciplinary, but we want suspension pending the criminal matter. I think it boils down to, as the Honourable Mbulwana and Swart said, the seriousness of the matter and ultimately the fact that we are not only looking at a matter of employment and employment-related charges, but a criminal matter as a matter of fact. I think, given the fact that they have been served a notice of a hearing, we are well within our rights to say that we confirm the suspension and keep it in place for now.
The law. You're about the law. The law is in terms of magistrates commission act.
They come to us, and every 3 months a report must be submitted to Parliament, and then we consider the issue. So that's the magistrate's court is the basis. Had they not instituted their charge sheet already in the disciplinary hearing, it would have lapsed. So there is that protection as well, Jane. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Just to clarify, I want to add what Mr. Swart said. Mr. Homa has already for his been provision suspended from office, and this has confirmed the provision suspension. So in terms of our act, section decision test, we need to file progress reports on a 3-month basis, and this is what this report is. It's a progress report on the progress made in the disciplinary inquiry. And this case, the commission didn't take it lightly to go back on its resolution, keep this inquiry pending the conclusion of the criminal matter. This criminal matter is a high profile. It's very, very sensitive. It's involved the question of case. So it's very sensitive, and we only ask this time for this committee to note that the commission took a resolution under these circumstances to keep the criminal matter in abeyance in order to request the prosecutor to prosecute the criminal act to also leave the evidence in the misconduct inquiry. But we'll keep up, the commission is...
I think the request is clear. Anyone has really a problem with that?
I didn't hear that part. I thought you're saying the prosecution is saying that we should hold on with the disciplinary action until they are told. Right. You are saying that, are you saying the same thing?
Chairperson, what I said, the commission confirms the request of the prosecution to keep the disciplinary inquiry in abeyance until conclusion of the criminal matter.
But here he's saying the man is on suspension.
He's provision suspended from office.
Chair, I'm doing that, but I do need to get up that again. We must do some checks and balance because we don't even have authority on how long the prosecution will take. If it takes 5 years, what happens then? And the man is suspended and so on. But we agree with your request. Thanks to say that they may have to give us a progress report on the month's basis so that we're able to track it down. Thanks.
Yeah, I think our financial legal basis should also look at the methods that are right for you. Before we attend this, we have a step of request coming from elsewhere. We think we would take our decisions from us. But otherwise, you have made a good case for now.
Just to say that this matter is very serious, the allegations are very serious, and it's good that the magistrate is on some suspension, but suspension with pay. In some of the cases, we actually looked at the issue of pay, whether to proceed with pay or not. Did you look at this matter in this particular case?
So then the commission would only if the man has been found guilty of offence or whether he, at the conclusion of a disciplinary inquiry, has been found guilty by the presiding officer, and there is a recommendation that he or she be removed from office without remuneration. In this case, he is only proven guilty only while he is innocent and proven guilty. When he takes it to the High Court, it will be very, very difficult to prove. They have to have a case to withhold remuneration. So it's very difficult. As soon as state witnesses have testified, I'm of the view that, but that's my personal view, that we may proceed with the discipline inquiry as soon as possible. But the commission has its hands on it. The commission has been requested to inform the commission also and advise the commission the progress on the matter on the agenda of the ethics of the full commission. Is every meeting to conclude whether we should proceed with the disciplinary inquiry in the law or not. And in any event, has to address the review on very regular progress reports on a 3 month basis. So, 3 months' time, and the criminal matter will be having had a long way still to go, I know, but hopefully, a few days have been set for this matter to proceed.
Was that a conversation with the that the thinking of the commission seems to be in line with what the honorable members have said, honorable, to say that we can allow the treatment things that are protected in this what support have we got?
It is correct, Jacob, that's what I said just now. The commission, I think, meeting on the 27th of February confirms previous resolution that will keep matter in abeyance. It was informed by the NPA that there was a trial in the trial and there was and the complainant already testified. So there is progress made in the criminal matter. So it's on the agenda of the commission's next meeting to be informed of the progress.
No, I think it's fine. I think at least there is a basis for us to oversee the process so that it doesn't become an endless process. So I think you are handling it well and we will allow that request.
Next. Briefly on the progress report of Mr. Hollick. Have you met Mr. Hollick? The top progress report, super difference. As you put it, there's an NCS attached as well to it. Honourable Chair, Mr. Hawley was previously suspended or having provision suspended from office. Pending an investigation to strip his old office, he's been charged with misconduct. But the provision suspension was lifted conditional for him to deal with all his parts of his matter. And this committee requested to be informed about the progress in that regard, as well as, of course, on the inquiry itself. With regard to the progress on the ascending matters, part-head matters, there were 26 cases part-head before him, and he finalized all of them except for 5. So he's getting an appointment every time to deal with these. So in that regard, he's making progress. As soon as he finalizes that, he will report that he will be suspended, the provision suspended. But there's also the Shin inquiry, he was an acting judge, and he really takes time to give everything in dispute and places points in relay and requesting the presiding officer to recuse himself. So there were many, many applications and arguments which had to be dealt with by the presiding officer. It took a lot of time. The hearing is now postponed. And it was postponed to 27 February and 27 March. So it has now been postponed to next week. Next week, hopefully the hearing is going to continue. And we hope we can leave the evidence. But as far as this concerns, there were a lot of arguments, legal arguments, which were dealt with by the deciding officer. There was arguments on both sides, written arguments. We had to study it. Initially, he asked for the department to shoot his book for legal representation. And that was denied because that took about a year. So a year later, and we haven't commenced the cleaning of evidence yet. Like I said, we're studying everything. The dispute is very important to eliminate. The last time he was apparently off sick, or he was not there, it was in October. Then he again appeared in person, instead of having an attorney with him. And he was informed that he had to make a contact with his council after he started his journey from Johannesburg, and he was informed that the documents were in his council, so he didn't have his documents with him, so he couldn't proceed with the particular inquiry. These are just a few of the issues which are raised, the difficulties we have. the commission is doing its very best to have this misconduct hearing to complete and to meet really the evidence. And if we take some exception to really three postponements, it is of course the ultimate responsibility of the presiding officer to be in a fair trial.
Why do you seem to be complaining about applications for refusal, applications for legal aid, statements? But those are the rights that flow from the law. So what you want to have to do with that, because we can't stop the operation of law.
Yes, I totally agree with you, but since I mean, it's not that the commission takes notice of the fact that it happens. You make that application, you have the right to make those applications. It just delays the matter. It just delays the conclusion of the disciplinary inquiry. But you have rights, of course. And the deciding officer makes rulings in this regard. And sometimes the rulings are made not as you say, in favor of the commission. He wants to take those on review. He has the right to do so. But it prolongs the conclusion of the disciplinary inquiry.
The law as it stands now. It's like the debate that we just had, where people say the Constitution gives too much power to the President to appoint certain officials, and the Constitution is there. Now, are we going to pick and choose which sections of the Constitution we use, or which sections of the law we use? Because as Parliament, we have the right to amend legislation. But before legislation is amended, we are going to respect the Constitution as it stands now, the legislation as it stands now, the frustrations that we have there, if you are not happy with them. That's what the executive to initiate your amendments, we will deal with the amendments. But we are not going to deal with the complaints about how the law works, because that's not how the law is, and we said it's a modern law.
Yeah, thanks. I just want to know that how are they keeping up with the magistrate who's facing charges from the commission, and the same as they're having to do the last finishing is the holder that is in front of him. How is it? How do they coincide with the whole thing? Is it not affecting the size of the other guys in one way or another?
Yeah, I didn't hear the question.
Can you just give us a reconciliation of how are you keeping up with the having to deal with the person that must face charges from the commission, and the LCN person is busy finalizing some of these public health matters and is doing well. What are you just appraising the committee support? What is the state of affairs in that situation?
My question is also on this line. She says, Magistrate Holly was suspended and he was actually recalled because there was work that required his presence, and he has come back and has done a good job because we haven't had any complaints about the quality of work that he's doing. And when you look at the charges, it's about insubordination, it's about abuse of power, and you actually wonder about the gravity of the complaint. Is something that needs to be there repeatedly? Because this has been going on for years. Well, I shouldn't actually look at a way of raising my team to control this matter so that we can be able to have enough energy to deal with matters like the one that we have just discussed now, Mr. Home.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, I think there was a concern. He was signed in sexual offences for serving stakeholders in a consultative meeting requested, because of the need to talk, and there were a lot of positive matters, that it be the interest of justice to finalize those criminal cases. And he was allowed to, whilst he was in the recent suspension, that the recent suspension be lifted permit, the congregation permit to deal with this copyright matter. Now he dealt with especially one of those 26 copyright matters. That's an issue for justice. Only these cases were allocated to and he's not supposed to do any new cases. He's not involved in this in Kadala. There's another matter he's found to do with the institution to raise queries and to communicate with Mr. Ward directly. So Mr. Nicarala is not involved, but in that regard, we want to have this matter dealt with. In the meantime, while he's doing these, finalizing these party references, the next coming inquiry is to proceed. If that's what I'm going to tell the question about, I hope I answered the question.
I think that's what we want. That's what we're given.
My question there was, why did the presiding officer dismiss the application for approval, and at the same time, order for portfolio that the man should go to consult his counsel? Why? Do you know why? Or you didn't even have another presiding officer to tell you?
Chair, we need to bear in mind this is a report from the chairman of the Magistrates Commission, Judge Lakhudi. And it is purely a report on progress with the finalization of the criminal case. Because we made it a condition when we uplifted the suspension to be apprised on a regular basis as to the finalization of those popular criminal cases. It's got nothing to do with disciplinary action at this stage. So, sure, we just need to be in mind. That's why there is the annexure attached at the end as to the finalization of the criminal cases, and the judge Lakhudi says follow-up reports will be submitted to parliament on a regular basis to report on progress of finalization of Mr. Bolle's partner's matter. We asked that when we uplifted the suspension and we set out in paragraph 1 on what condition we were prepared to do that. So, Chair, that is what we've now ascertained, that 21 of these 26 cases are finalized. In the meantime, the disciplinary action is continuing, and we obviously will get reports on that as it goes ahead. But I'm also concerned, Chair, and this again gets back to the principles we were discussing earlier that we need to grapple with as a new committee. Again, the issues of delays in finalizing disciplinary action. And yes, Chair, you're 100% correct when you say, and a person's taking disciplinary action is entitled to every avenue of the law, but as we engage in these matters, you'll find that there are classic delaying tactics are used continually to prevent the finalisation of these matters. If you take on paragraph page 3, for example, there after many, many postponed, eventually the misconduct hearing having been proffered to be proceeded on the 13th of October. The accused person has got an advocate representing him, an advocate. Even the advocate says, no, he's not leading evidence. Anyone can, for the attorney can lead evidence. But no, another advocate is going to lead evidence. That's an abusive process. Then he says, you haven't got all the documents. The person leading the evidence says, I've got the document. You follow Chester, without getting into that engagement, you can see here where the Constitution allows person legal representation. They've got legal representation. But it's, again, classic postponement tactics. And this is the dilemma that when I served on the Magistrates Commission for a long time, the dilemma where Parliament requires speedy finalisation of these matters, but there is delays that occur, and you're correct that there are in terms of that person's constitutional rights. There's very little we can do. So, Chair, we need to just look and focus our attention on the issue of the finalization of those passwords matters. And it is correct that at the end of the day, should the magistrate satisfactorily complete all those matters, that could well be to his benefit in the disciplinary action, because that could be a mitigatory circumstance. So there's a link between the two, but our function today is to look at the passwords disciplinary action, passwords sexual offences matters, because there's a high court application, if I remember correctly, against the department and the Magistrates Commission for placing him under suspension so that he could not do those matters. So we're responding to a High Court application that was brought by NGOs concerned about women and children's cases that were not being finalized. So that is why this comes from the Magistrate Commission Chairman himself, the judge. Thank you.
I think actually Honourable Swart have spoken for us. You see, we were concerned about the fate of the apartheid matter. And then court by Judge Lugodi assures us that everything is in place, there is progress, and is a satisfactory report by the judge. Now the delaying tactics, that's not something that we in this committee we can't deal with. So the judiciary must deal with it. They are lawyers. Now if they think the law is not workable, makes things ungovernable, then that's another train of amendment of the laws. We don't want to get with it because there's no proposal between us. But also another important point that Honorable Sartre is making is that you know, the cooperation of this man, he had come back, he was charged of insubordination, but now here he is back, he's towing the line, he's doing good work, and no new complaints, and that should somewhere work in his favor, but it's not for this one to deal with that, but we just know that you know, his conduct now seems to negate some of the allegations made before them. I don't want to enter into that. We just want to take it back and see how to do it. But otherwise, we're happy with your report on this matter. We're happy with the judges' report. So what next?
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. Corporate, from Corporate and the Chief Magistrate of Council Hawk. She was charged with misconduct. Charges were served on her. She is already previously suspended from office. In the latest few days, the defense raised numerous points in Limay before we could commence with the Supreme Inquiry, and the applications were offered before the signing office on the 6th of October last year. Her application was successful only in respect of one count. The deciding officer postponed the inquiry to the 16th of January 2015 for hearing. The defense requested a postponement because, again, they said that they do not have all the documents, which was the postponement which was objected. But the deciding officer allowed the postponement, thought it was reasonable. Chairperson, the matter was then postponed. For this report, on the 29th of December, so what I'm saying to you now will be reported in the next report, which will be by the end of this month, in the next progress report. But it was postponed to the 23rd and 25th of February 2015 for hearing. The 23rd, Ms. von Feldwijk informed the starting officer that her mother passed away, and she could not postpone it. The postponement was granted, and the matter came to no postponement. 20th and 21st of April 2015 for me. Um, recall that in the provincial extension was approved by Parliament, Ms. Malashera had a notice of motion pending in the High Court. She filed this notice of motion on the 18th of January of June, sorry, 2014, citing the Commission and the Minister of Justice as the first and the first respondent. She applied for an order for the court in the area to declare the Commission's decision to charge her with misconduct to be wrongful and unlawful. The application is opposed and we are still busy with the litigation. On behalf of the Commission, we have two magistrates who are consulting with counsel to oppose this application. So the application is still pending before court. In the meantime, she has seen provisions suspended. She has been served with the charge sheet and the notice of hearing, and the notice of hearing set the date of hearing to commence on the 11th of May 2015. That's the earliest possible date for her attorney or legal representative, as well as the defining officer, and certainly the evidence to commence with this inquiry. We'll give you an update again by the end of the month. That will be the same person.
Thank you.
We heard with our updates. We will await the next report and
Chairperson, and then again, I'm lucky to say that we are happy that Mr. Rambeau, the last matter, Mr. Rambeau, he also faced a prolonged disciplinary inquiry that we've been informed that on the 6th of October 2014, Mr. Rambeau extended the resignation. So he's not the judicial officer any longer, so we don't have any jurisdiction over him, and we just continued our disciplinary hearing, and we closed our file on this matter.
Yes, that's it.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Just a question, maybe for information's sake. What is the position at the magistrate commission with a magistrate who resigned while a disciplinary hearing pending? Is that record kept? Or if the information kept on record, will it be taken into account if such a person, for example, applies again in 5 years to become to be appointed as a magistrate? Because I think we struggle a lot in public service with this thing of people who are charged and then they resign, and then ultimately there are no consequences for what they were charged for, even though it was not guilty.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I know there was a provision in the Public Service Act, if I'm not mistaken, way back before 1994, that if you resign or vacate office while the Supreme Inquiry was pending against you, you were deemed to be guilty of the charge. It was found to be unconstitutional. It's not applicable to magistrates are independent and judicial officers. They are not public servants. So this comes even more to magistrates. That I hear what Mr. Wong says, and we appreciate it. If the deputy manager or the minister approaches the commission for an acting appointment, the common practice is that they request our office to do a search on these people, and we have a database on all the matches who have been removed from office or where there were disciplinary actions taken against them. And we will inform the deputy minister and the minister before any appointment is made to at least inform the minister so that he can make a well-informed decision before any appointment. But permanent appointments are for developed by the commission. All these recommendations, as soon as a person has been shortlisted, that name will be provided to the Ethics Division, and we will inform the Commission if there is any problems or disciplinary inquiries against that person.
The next one?
The next one is Mr. Meraki, Chairperson. Mr. Meraki is the reason to send it from office without remuneration. Whoever still has the means to appoint senior counsel in this regard to representing the Supreme Inquiry. I'm very important to say that we are making progress in this inquiry. We were able to release evidence in January 2013. I don't want to take it too way back. The matter was then postponed by Ministry of Government to be filled in the fall of April 2013 for continuation. We had further evidence, and the matter was again postponed between 2nd and 26th July. The Commission has about 20 witnesses to give evidence. Then the presiding officer was appointed as an acting judge, not to vary himself for the inquiry to continue in July. The matter was postponed to 4th and 5th November to give both parties an opportunity to raise a consultation, which could to eliminate any disputes, further disputes. The matter was then postponed to 15 and 16 October for further hearing and arguments. The hearing did not continue on these days due to the unavailability of both the Supreme Office counsel and the presiding officer. It was then postponed between 14 and 5 November last year. We subpoenaed 6 witnesses to testify during these 2 days. Both Mr. Meraki's counsel were absent on the 24th of November. The presiding officer phoned counsel, confronted him about this, and it appeared that Mr. Meraki and his counsel strongly noted the dates of the hearing. He died at 26 and 27, instead of 24 and 25. Mr. Meraki did not appear on the 25th either. He indicated that he had no transport to attend the hearing and that he would only be available on the 26th of November. That's about his stay in Rustenburg and he had to go to Pretoria. I don't know, I can't, because it's not made a difference. Arrangement that he got. There's only one person written that could testify. The inquiry was again postponed in the presence of Mr. Meraki and his counsel on 28, 29, 30th of January for further hearing. We did this for the evidence, and then it will be postponed to tomorrow, and the day after tomorrow for further hearing. The person gave the evidence. I commence with this to myself, but unfortunately, due to the volume of work we have, the commission appointed Ms. The clerk and acting chief magistrate to proceed and continue the reading of the evidence and health of the commission. The test is almost done, so hopefully tomorrow we will, for the day after tomorrow, the commission will close its case on the matter. And then Mr. Meraki indicated that he will testify, and he had a lot of witnesses to testify as well. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. I hear from the family where the suspend without pay, why the suspend.
Chairperson, he's not been found guilty as yet. He has been found guilty on 2 charges of this, of which he's charged, and the disciplinary charges also include that, but he's taking that on appeal. That, however, he has made an application for leave to appeal, which is 2 years down the lane, because he says that the record has to be reconstructed. We have even the presiding officer in the criminal trial now, a full version of the whole form, everything that we could have laid our hands on to the deciding officer. So it's not that the record has been reconstructed, but hopefully in 2 weeks and then in March. That has been set out in March, or April, if I'm not mistaken, for an application for leave to appeal against the conviction on 2 charges of this. But that's part of our disciplinary process as well.
Yes, that's a question.
very much the important question. Our organization, you will see that we raise political issues. And some of the issues we raise may even be in conflict with the law itself, which is not wrong, because we are a parliament that must transform. So I think you should be helpful to us, that the things that we raise may be not in order in terms of the status quo, but may be correct in terms of where we want to transform, where we want to take the country. So I think after sessions like this, we should sit back and say, what is it that is being raised? Is it legitimate that we advance the transformation or not? So we really want your guidance in this work. Don't be observant, but just make notes for the library. Yeah. So this brings us to the end. And I would just request that your comments, your recommendations, if you bring them to the chair, and I'll share with the other members. But I think that we need to transform the leader system. This time is not transformation of just the structure. We want to deal with the content and transform the content. And so you have a critical role to play in that regard. Thank you.
Sorry to go ahead.